The Living Clean podcast is not affiliated with Narcotics Anonymous, nor do we speak on behalf of NA as a whole. We are simply members sharing our personal experiences and perspectives in recovery-based discussions. The opinions expressed here are our own and not those of Narcotics Anonymous as a fellowship. This is the Living Clean podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. Okay, welcome back to the Living Clean podcast. This is Mason S. I'm an addict. We're back for another episode. We are going to feature an interview today. With our man Vito. We're very grateful to have Vito come and have a discussion with us. First, we're going to get into your introduction. I'm going to kick it over to Francis.
My name is Francis. I'm an addict. My clean date is December 22nd, 1992. And my home group is You Are the Book, Book Study. We meet on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. So we just met this morning. And we're kind of like an in-depth book study, and we meet at 6:30 in the morning in Chico, California. We're into step 11. It's been pretty meaningful and powerful. So, super grateful to have Vito here. Yeah, Vito, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm an addict called Vito. My clean date is 2/14/1960. My home group is 12 o'clock high in Hollywood, Florida.
Okay. So just celebrated 65 years.
Yep. Well, a couple weeks ago, and I just went to Marty E's celebration last night. He picked up 50 years.
50 years. Did you ever see this day?
I think I lived to be over 25, to be honest with you. But God made a fool out of me here. I'm 85 and put together with duct tape, but still going.
Still going.
Yeah.
So you got clean when you were 20?
When I was 20, yes.
Most of the time, of course, I wasn't around then, but most of the time, the first introduction to 12-step recovery is usually in AA. Was that your experience?
No, my first introduction was into the other NA in New York City. There was another NA that started in 1949 by Danny Carlson and Ray Lopez. And Ray Lopez, she was my first sponsor. I got clean at the end of 1958, and I was 1 year clean before I relapsed. And then I came back in 1960.
What did that fellowship, you know, like... I don't like to say that they're different than our fellowship, but
they were much different because of the fact of the Rockefeller laws in New York. If you were ever busted for an opiate in New York, you were issued a New York State opiate card. And if you were ever start even talking on the street with somebody else who had another opiate card, you both did 15 years in the joint. So they had to meet under the auspices of New York City Board of Health. Because it was a public agency, the narcotic squad couldn't bust you while you were in there. But as you left the meetings, you had to go out one by one, single file, and not talk to anybody on the street. Otherwise, you'd be busted. So it didn't cooperate. In 1955, Jimmy Kay and Danny Carlson were talking about merging the two fellowships. But because of the Rockefeller laws, they couldn't merge it because the traditions couldn't be upheld under the Rockefeller laws. That fellowship lasted till 1972 when Ray Lopez died, and they changed the name of that fellowship to Drugs Anonymous. And in 1980, when they repealed the Rockefeller laws, this fellowship came in and the Drug Anonymous just disappeared right into Narcotics Anonymous.
Wow, that's interesting. Did you ever get a chance to meet Danny Carlson?
I met him when I was 13 years old. I was belonged to, back then there was a lot of territory gangs in New York, and I was war counsel for that gang, and there was a fellow from New York City Youth Council called Danny Murrow. He took me to the NA meeting, and I think it was 53, And I met Donnie Carlson and laughed at the whole thing and said I didn't want to be with these bunch of people because they didn't know what life was all about. So I met Danny Carlson for a couple seconds, and that was basically it. But the woman that started the fellowship with him, Mary Lopez, she became my sponsor in 1958 until I relapsed in 59. And then in 62, I went to San Diego because I met a bunch of people at a rapid meeting in New Jersey and followed them out to San Diego.
So what happened in 59? What ultimately what happened for you to go back out?
Well, at that time, I was smuggling drugs out of Havana, Cuba. I used to take the Greyhound bus down to Key West, and they had a ferry that ran between Key West and Havana back then. And you get on the ferry and you go to Havana. I go to the hotel, National Hotel, which was run by Meyer Lansky and the mob. I would pick up a picnic basket with a false bottom, all with heroin that was coming in from Sicily to Little Italy in Havana. And I would take it back to Key West, get on the bus. I made that trip twice a month. And the
Wow.
last time I was there was on New Year's Eve, 1959. And that's when Castro marched into the city. And I got the last ferry boat out without my package. And when I got back to New York, I got beat almost to death. They didn't kill me because they just had to make an example. It doesn't matter what the excuse is, you don't follow through. And so I relapsed at that point and lived in a dumpster for a year.
And it didn't matter that you went down and attempted. It was just the fact that you didn't come back with anything.
Examples had to be made.
Wow.
Excuses didn't matter. And it probably changed my life because it took me out of the direction of being towards the mob and that type of stuff. So it was probably a lifesaver when you go back and look at it because my whole life went in a different direction.
Wow.
So it was one of those divine interventions, I guess.
You were clean in the fellowship. Are in the Danny Carlson's NA from 58, but you were still involved in that lifestyle, making
Oh
these
yeah,
runs.
I didn't think drugs had anything to do with it. I had to make a living.
Wow.
But that's the mentality of somebody 19 years old, a wannabe, that type thing. But it got me clean. Then I relapsed. I got clean again. I met a bunch of people that were hippies from San Diego at a meeting in back of an AA meeting. It was one of those rabbit meetings the basic text talks about, and got involved with them and eventually followed them out to San Diego. And that
So
was in
that's kind of, I think I've heard that story before. I think I know I've heard some of your shares before, but there was, did they call that like animal, did they have something called an animal table where they put addicts at the table?
When I finally got out of the hospital, I lived in a dumpster for a year, and I was suffering from infectious and serum hepatitis. And so when I collapsed making a hustle at a place called Brick Church Station in New Jersey, they took me to a hospital and they told me I was suffering from both infectious and serum hepatitis. And I was there for 3 or 4 weeks. Then they put me into what was known as the alcoholic ward because there was no such thing as detox or rehabs then, where you just hang out and dry and play poker all day long. And when I left there, they gave me a meeting list for AA, and they threw me out because they said my disease was immoral and illegal. And they told me I could go to open meetings, and I went to these big open meetings in Newark, New Jersey. And all the addicts would wait outside to the last minute and come in, and people would disappear, move on the other side of the room because they said we were animals. Our disease was illegal and immoral, and they didn't want anything to do with us. And this hippie group came in, they rented the back room, and they had a meeting back there, and it was a NA meeting of Jimmy Cage thing. And that's where I met those guys, and then followed them back out to San Diego. And I stayed
Was
in San
this,
Diego up to the early 70s.
what group was this?
What group was what?
The hippie group that came from San
Oh,
Diego, was
that
it?
was. They were just rabbit meetings. Back in the 70s, they'd have rabbit be here 3, 4 weeks and then just disappear. They talk about that in the basic text. They were not continuous meetings. They'd come in, they bring the hippies, they go to another commune, they go to another town. But when I
Yeah, I
went
thought it might
out
have
to San,
been, like Tom Canton and Tom McCall got clean with the
well,
Flowbird and her married
Snowbird,
pranksters.
that was out in Hawaii. That was Snowbird. That was, but it's a little bit different. But it was the same general principle. It was the hippies hanging around, And when I went out to San Diego, I thought I'd find NA all over the place. And we only had two meetings. One was at a big Catholic church up in Mission Hill. The other was in East San Diego at the Black Panther Clubhouse. And we had to work like hell to begin. Then in the late 60s, late 60s, 68, 69, a guy came in by the name of Don Zeller. And I mentioned his last name because Don's been dead for a number of years. He came into San Diego and he really got the fellowship going and built it to what it was today. And I had moved up to Santa Ana and then to Santa Barbara and then back to the East Coast. So I was back in the East Coast around 77, 78, around that particular time.
So I'm going to ask a very simple question. Like, what was meetings like back then compared to today? Like in San Diego, was it the same similar format? Like you come in, read the
Well,
readings?
the readings were much different. I mean, first of all, the only piece of literature you had, the white book, but it was sort of beige color back then. The readings were much different. If you look at the old readings prior to 1987, where they had, we were grateful to how to the AA Fellowship and all that, that all changed in 87. But the basic of the meetings were the same. Matter of fact, I have a meeting on video from the Survivors Club in East North Hollywood, no, East Hollywood in California, where Jimmy was in there, Bob Barrett was there, Fahm was there, Doug Forsythe was there, the early members of NA in the Valley there. And the readings and everything are on there are much different than what they are today, but they're still basically NA readings.
Right.
I'm glad to share that video with you. I can Dropbox it to you.
Yeah, I would love to see
I
that.
mean, it's Jimmy's there, Betty Kay's there, Bob Barrett was there. Matter of fact, he was managing the Survivors Club at that time. He was my sponsor for 35 years before he died. Fawn was on there, and Doug Forsythe, who's dead now, that was Fawn's boyfriend at the time, but he was producing documentaries in the Hollywood at that time. And he had an operation, and the damn doctors left scissors inside of him, and that's what killed him.
Holy hell.
But he was Jimmy's right-hand man.
I understand he was had been to some of the literature conferences that wrote the basic text too. You know, like he's kind of an interesting character. And I see his name in a lot of the World Service Conference, early World Service Conference minutes.
Video, you know.
Did you ever go to the Survivors Club?
I went to the Survivors Club, yeah, but not very often because by that time they were rolling. I was going back to the East Coast, but Bob was managing the Survivors Club at that time. He was living
Yeah.
up above that, and he was a mechanic at Paramount Studios.
Yeah, I was down in Southern California this last November around Thanksgiving, and I tried to find the site of the Survivors Club, but I don't know if the building is even there anymore.
I don't know. I don't
Yeah.
know, but the video, it was filmed in the Survivors Club.
Yeah, I've seen the video. It's interesting.
Well, let's go back to where you talked about the hospital telling you that what you had was immoral and illegal.
It wasn't the hospital, it was the AA meetings when I got out
Oh,
of
the AA meetings. Gotcha.
the
Did you buy into
hospital.
that concept?
Do I buy into that
Did
concept?
you buy into that concept
No,
then?
absolutely not.
Okay.
It was a way of life. It wasn't immoral or illegal to me. It was just a way of life. Everybody I knew did that. Where
Right.
I grew up in the Bronx, by the time you were 6, 7 years old, you were sniffing Carbona, which was spot remover, or dry cleaning fluid, and then on the pot, and then mainlining heroin. So to me, that was just a normal way of life.
Gotcha.
I know in some parts of the country, drugs weren't prevalent back then, but in the New York City, drugs were like that since the 1930s.
Let's talk about sponsorship in the early days. What did that kind of look like? You talked
Well,
about Bob being your sponsor, but that wasn't your first sponsor.
no, Bob wasn't my first sponsor. I went the first 5 years without a sponsor because I couldn't buy into the concept of somebody was greater than me and this God stuff. So I stayed around it. So I didn't get a sponsor until I was out in San Diego, and that's where I got my first sponsor. I think I was like 3 or 4 years clean at that particular point. Of course, I was on the verge of relapsing almost on a weekly basis, but and I watch people come in, they're getting better, so there must be something to steps and there must be something to sponsorship. Fortunately, I survived.
What did you see in Bob that you liked?
Bob was a very open-minded guy. I don't know if you knew Bob personally, but Bob was, I would call him the master manipulator. He'd be able to skirt around any controversy and be on both sides of it the whole time. Like when the Purist movement came out and the baby blues, Bob and Greg would be right there, the master manipulators. They would be on both sides, and everybody loved them from both sides. Bob more so than Greg. Greg stayed in the middle too.
Yeah, I think that there was a falling out with Jimmy and the two of them, but Bob was able to get back in with Jimmy, and then
Well,
Greg was not as much.
it was a farce. What had happened is Greg had moved to Oregon. He was up in Oregon. He left the greater LA area. And he went up there, and he was, if you know Greg was poor most of his life. He could not handle money. You know, we all have our problems, but with Greg, financially, he was always a disaster. So he was up there, and he couldn't communicate and come back to California and everything. And while he was gone, this is when the controversy came with the basic text. Chuck Skinner, if I don't know if you know the name Chuck Skinner, he was from Manhattan Beach, I believe. Chuck was an old military guy. He was very disciplined and everything. And Jimmy, too, they both did not like the idea that both so got involved and got the basic text done, because Jimmy was going to get the basic text done for years and years and years. Never happened. Because Jimmy was a procrastinator in some areas. In other areas, he was very, very good for NA. And Chuck was right there with him. And so what happened, there was a board of trustees meeting, and that's when they began you know the history of the basic text. The first edition was a false edition. It wasn't what we approved. And then when the second edition came out, the second edition had the fourth and ninth tradition a little bit different in the explanation than so forth. Chuck was totally against the ninth, the way the traditions were written, and he wanted the office to have more power than the fellowship, because if they left it the way it was, the office would be subservient to the fellowship's group conscience. And Chuck believed that too, because Chuck and Jimmy did not want to lose control of NA. Greg had a different atmosphere. Greg believed in group conscience. He was always a group conscious guy, and he spoke about it. So Chuck sort of slid and told Jimmy that Greg is trying to push Jimmy out and take the fellowship over, and they called Greg a Judas from that point on. But that wasn't true. It wasn't true at all. Greg was blamed for that, but he was an NA man all the way, and he believed in the traditions. He just disagreed with Chuck and Jimmy on that the office should have more power than the fellowship. And we see the result of it today. You know, and it is, and there's nothing we can do about it. NA is still the best place you can go.
It's crazy that all this time later we still see the remnants
Yeah,
of that
but you had that
situation.
guy in Tennessee, Dale. Dale was a big, you know, you probably knew everybody in Tennessee knew Dale.
Dale Spencer.
Yep, and he made his point pragmatically. But you know, that's a war that has been fought since 1987, and people got to surrender. You got to surrender. It is what it is. We're not the same fellowship we were in 87.
What happened in 1987? Was that the third edition revised?
No, well, that's when Grateful Dave and Billy Allen
Oh.
came out with the Baby Blue and took the office to court, and the fellowship was divided. And then Grateful Dave actually won the lawsuit. He happened to die before it can go into the thing. And that really even made a big split, because when he died and he didn't finish up what was supposed to be done, then people really got against the office. And the fight is going on today, and it's absolutely crazy. And you know, I don't know why people are still doing it. I just saw a video that came out of Iran, which they got two regions in Iran now. One is very pro-Nas, the other is pro-Billy Allen. And so they're buying all their literature through Billy Allen, and this guy is saying, fuck Nas, this and that, and so forth. And it's like, come on, guys, let's surrender and have some unity in this fellowship. We're not going to go back to 1987. It's not going to happen. We still got a good fellowship. Let's move forward with it. But all during this time, Bob and Greg were the master manipulators. They were on both sides of the thing, and everybody loved them. They knew how to skirt that fence.
That's interesting you say that, because that is definitely the truth. Both sides will use something that Bob or Greg did
Exactly.
to justify the way that they feel.
Yeah. They were master manipulators. Not that they were bad guys, because I love Greg and he was my sponsee brother and I love Bob, but they knew how to play the game. And nobody hated either one of them from either side.
You probably don't even remember meeting me, but you were at Out of the Darkness a couple of years ago in Decatur, Alabama.
Oh yeah, the Huntsville Convention, great place.
Yep. We had Chris there to do the history of the basic
Yeah,
text.
Chris and Boyd do a wonderful job.
Do you remember? One of the things I've always shared about that stuck out to me was at the end of the presentation, they asked for people in the audience to share their experience with the basic text, and you shared how instrumental the basic text was to you and how important it was. And I never will forget, your share on that. Talk about what that basic text really meant and how important it was from somebody, because you were clean, what, 23 years before we had a basic text.
Well, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was the book that was used in all NA meetings for 28 years. And people got clean on it. People like Bob, Sylvia, for instance, Sylvia, she was up in the, she came out of LA, but she was up outside of San Francisco at one point.
Berkeley,
Berkeley, right.
Sylvia Magdalena.
Right, and a lot of them just couldn't come to the NA language. Now, the NA language was, I don't know if you guys knew Jim Miller out of Ohio, and I sponsored Jim. Jim invented what we call the NA language. At that time, he was doing the magazine for NA, and he started a lot of things, and he got the NA language going, which caused the purist movement. Because people, well, to give you an idea, I went to Marty E's 50th anniversary, and Marty spoke at a convention, Center City, Philadelphia. I think it was 82 and 83, and we were talking about it last night. And the basic text had just come out, and he was up there, and he was at the podium. He had the big book in one hand, and he had the basic text in the other hand. Now, up in the Northeast, everybody used the big book to get clean because that was it. We had no literature, and he raised it, and he took the big book, and he threw it in the trash can. And hell, we're going to be using this book from now on, and they start throwing tomatoes at him. For a lot of people, the welcoming of the basic text was not welcome because they got clean on the big book and they couldn't understand what was wrong because that was their book. They got clean on it. 22 groups in Philadelphia left Narcotics Anonymous and started Addicts Anonymous because they would not use the basic text. So there was different views on that. And it wasn't that the basic text was no good. They got clean on the big book, and I dare you tell me I can't use that, and I can't use the word sober, and so forth. And it was a very big thing for those people. Jim helped a lot by coming with the NA language to be able to ease into the big book, into the basic text. But there were a lot of people across the country who never would accept it. Chuck Skinner, in a letter, and I have the copy of that letter that he wrote Greg when Greg was in Oregon, and he kept calling the basic text the NA big book. They just wouldn't let that go. And I understand for a lot of those people because I was one of them that got clean on the big book because that's all we had. But there comes a time to surrender. We got something new. We wanted the book. We wanted it. So what? We got clean on it. Doesn't mean the big book is bad, but we have our book now. And that made a big difference in the fellowship's growth. Without that basic, because we actually wrote that book. All the other literature we have, we did not write. I remember. And I didn't go to the conferences, although I knew Bo and all the people that went. A guy from our home group, at that time I was living in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and we would send this guy Egon for to go to the conferences because he had a couple bucks and so forth. He could do it, and he would carry our group conscience and what we wanted in the book and so forth there. So it was not only the literature committee that wrote it; it was groups all over the country that had representatives that went to the conference and brought their input in. And so we actually wrote that book. It was something that we wrote. And then when the Gray Book came out, and then it was too big for us to publish. And I don't know if you know the history of the Gray Book, but we went line by line. Joe Proctor's company or his family printed it because we couldn't afford to print the Gray Book. It was too big for our budget at that time. So we voted on what lines to keep and what not to keep. But we were supposed to come out with an advanced text afterwards, but so damn much money came in, it never happened.
Wow.
But the people involved in writing it were so excited, but there were a lot of people who weren't in service. They say, "Well, we got clean on the big book. So what? We're used sober and sobriety. So what? That's we've been using it for years." And these guys had 10, 15, 20 years clean. So you can understand. And Sylvia, right to the end, she'd say, "Fuck that, I got sober." That's just her attitude, because she was grateful for getting the big book, getting her started. Her and her brothers. I think she had four brothers that were in recovery at that time. I think only one is alive now.
Yeah, Richard Magdaleno, he lives in San Jose.
Yeah, as a matter of fact,
You
my sponsee brother Oscar, I'm sponsored by Norm in Los Angeles, Norm S.
Oh
And
yeah, he's
one
got
of his
some time.
sponsees is Oscar, sponsors the Magdaleno brother.
It's interesting. Chris kind of set me and Mason on a quest to listen. I've been listening to it, but it's the writing of the big book, and like the only thing I was thinking about is like it took Bill Wilson 4 years to write the big book. Like from the time that they him and Bob met, and it was kind of a push for money, like another parallel. But but they weren't able to separate from the Oxford group until the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous came out. In fact, their name came from the name of the book. Alcoholics, they named their book Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how the fellowship got named Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it took us what literally 30 years to get a book. And we were so like AA was embedded in the Oxford group, and they weren't able to get free from the Oxford group until they had a book. And it's I kind of see the same parallel with Narcotics Anonymous. But it took us so long to get a book that, we were that much more embedded in that fellowship. The struggle was even harder for us. I'm done.
Always
Sorry.
called the stepchild of AA back then.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing was, once Bo got involved in it, it only took 2 years to get the book done, because he had the drive and he wanted to do it. Norm tells me back in 1970 that he has literature when they started to write the basic text back then, and it just kept dying. Nobody could keep it going. And when Bo showed up in San Francisco at the World Convention, he pestered Greg and Jimmy so much. Jimmy just says, "You want to write a book? Here, take the fucking thing and go write it." And he did it in 2 years, because Bo did not write it. Bo was the spearhead. Bo was the one that put the committee together and got things done. Who else can do it? That's why Bo, we call the father of the basic text. Not that he did the writing, he made it happen. He made it happen. Nobody could have done it except Bo. He had Greg on the phone for 9 hours doing the tradition board of the thing, where they shut Greg's phone off. He couldn't pay the phone bill.
I
But
love
Bo
that
is a
story.
motivator. I mean, he still is. Bo's a great guy. Today, he's hard to deal with sometimes, a little dementia coming in, because he's an old man like me. But he's a great guy. And if it wasn't for Bo, we would not have the text. He made it happen. And I give him credit for that.
Absolutely.
He made it happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah, we
Absolutely.
recently talked to him for a few hours about the basic text. He took us through the whole process. It
Oh,
was
he's an
fascinating.
amazing man. Amazing man. For
Yep.
somebody on LSD his whole life, his mind's still working pretty good, except for dementia. He's a great guy. And
He was
we always have to
a
be grateful to Bo, because without him, it wouldn't have happened. He just had that passion and desire to want to do it.
Chris and I were interviewing people for the that were at the literature conferences, and so I was on a hunt for the young lady that was on the phone call with Greg, like the woman that was transcribing.
Right.
And I had, like if we were looking for her a couple of years before, we would have found her, but she had passed away. I found her obituary, and part of my search for her was I found some of her relatives, and they didn't even know that about the phone call or her involvement or anything like that. So I got to share that story about her being on the phone for 9 hours to help us, put together the basic text, and it was super meaningful for her family to hear that. So backtracking,
Right.
sharing a story with a family member became
What is
meaningful to the family
from
member
the Midwest
that
someplace?
What's that?
Wasn't she from the Midwest someplace?
Her name was Molly, and she was from Sioux City, Iowa.
Yes, I thought it was out in the Midwest.
Yeah.
That was part of the old Mid-America region, which is
Yeah.
split into 1,000 regions now.
You just celebrated 65 years on Valentine's Day. My question is, when's the last time you remember how to thought of using?
Every time I get pissed off,
Every time you get mad.
it's
Every
a
time.
fleeting thought, but it's there. There's no sitting and re and getting in touch with that. It just comes out, geez, I'd like to have a drink, or geez, I'd like to just nod off and not deal with all this shit and everything. But it's there and it's gone. It, one, two, three. But that's
I'll show
because
you. I'll throw away my 65 years.
no, I never think of that. That part of it. But I'm so close to the fellowship. I was a GSR, and now I'm an RRCM, and I'm involved with the region, the area. I go to area even when I'm not a GSR, just to be involved, because I believe service is the key that kept me here, and I'm not going to take a chance that I'm going to get too complacent and not be involved. My wife gets very pissed off at me that I get involved so much with it, but I feel, how can you say no to somebody that saved your life? And that's the way I
Wow.
look at it.
I love that. Yeah, and the reason why I asked you that question is because just to give some people some identification, that clean time doesn't necessarily cure us of this disease. We're still
Never
going to have
cured.
the it never cured. We're going to have those thoughts. My next question is, with the amount of clean time that you got, does it get frustrating sometimes feeling like you're put up on a pedestal because of that time?
I
Do you have
stop it immediately. I stop it immediately. I won't allow that to happen, because that feeds your ego. I just don't do it. I let people know that I can go out and use any time. And I always say, if you don't believe me, go ask my wife. She can tell you what an asshole I can be. And there's days that a newcomer has a better program than me. That's the reality of it. You may have time and say, oh, you got a great program, but we all fuck up all the time. It's just part of life. It's who we are. We're human beings. And I won't allow that to happen, because I have an ego like everybody else, and they can suck it up a little bit, and I don't like that. And everybody I know that's got a lot of long time, they don't allow that to happen. I mean, like Marty, he's a guy you should interview. 50 years, he really, is good. And I'm sure you've interviewed Mel. Mel was very sick, but he's starting to get healthy again, so he's able to be interviewed. And Chuck now is getting his 80s too. So these are people that aren't going to be here much longer. I mean, I like to say I'll be around another 10, 15 years, but it's not up to me. Not a question of if, it's a question of when. I'll just keep trucking. But there's so many now, and so many have died in the last 10 years. It's just unbelievable. We've lost a lot of people in the last 10 years that are going back to the history of NA.
I think find the whole clean time thing fleeting. And ego is like, I want to stay in the middle of the pack, but I do get a little bit of clout around my clean time. And is it my ego? I was listening to the Anonymous podcast this morning, the Just for Today, and then Douglas was saying, I protect my clean date. Because it's my life. I protect my recovery every day. And that's protecting my clean date. And I'm glad to be in the middle. I'm like in the middle between you and Mason. But is that ego or is that humility? I mean, I don't know what
Yeah,
that is, but
I think it's
like I
humility.
say, be proud of it or just protect it and just like let it be
Well,
whatever it
you should
is.
always be proud of it, but at the same time, you don't want to use it as a badge.
Right. Absolutely.
Years ago in conventions, they used to like to write your clean date on the. I don't like that, because it makes you different to somebody who doesn't have and doesn't understand. There's no difference between the old time and newcomer except experience. That's the only difference. It's
Yeah.
not time, it's experience during that time. And a newcomer will get that experience if they keep coming back and don't make obstacles such as, these are better people than me. No, we're all the same. We're all the same. We came in the same way. We may have stayed here and accumulated things, and life got better for us, but we're no different than the newcomer, because we came in on the balls of our ass just like they did. And we got to let them know that. There's no difference except experience.
Yeah, Vito's, Mason got clean as a young guy. Maybe he might be like being interviewed when he has 65 years.
Could be, could be.
Yeah, I don't know.
The idea is go to meetings, don't use between meetings, and don't die, and you'll get a lot of time.
That's right. That's right. It's the don't die part that I'm worried about.
The medicine today. I had a double bypass a few years ago, and I'm still going. Like I said, I got duct tape holding me together. I can't run and like I used to, but I get up every day and able to do what I need to do.
You was talking about earlier you had issues with the not only sponsorship but this whole God thing. What was that process like, and have you found a higher power that works for you?
Well, when I was young, very young, and I went to Catholic school, I had a God. I wanted to grow up and be a priest and all of that. And then I started using and the hell with God and all that stuff. And so when I came in, I was pretty much identifying myself as an agnostic. I didn't want to say atheist because I was afraid that just in case there was a God, he'd use it against me. I have a back door. I'm an addict. My sponsor told me, my first sponsor, he said, "Why don't you just take GOD and make it good orderly direction?" That made a lot of sense to me. Good orderly direction could be a higher power for me. And of course, through the years, that has changed tremendously, tremendously. I still don't believe in so much in a God of religion. I believe in a God of the universe. There's a force out there. I can't tell you what it is. It's certainly not a man. It's not a human being. Because if we were created in that image, our body just goes to dust eventually. But there's this power out there that whatever it is, and I am not going to try to waste my time figuring it out, is taking care of things. And if I want to be able to be part of everything on earth and go without too much rocking and rolling, I need to be part of that power. So that to me, that's the God of my understanding today. It really doesn't make any difference. When Bill wrote the steps, originally, at the end of the third step, it didn't read the way it does today. We made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. It said we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God, period. But back in the 1940s, there were more people coming in from mid-Jewish and Buddhists and so forth, and they added that the God as we understood him. And there's a big difference between God of our understanding and God as we understood him, because if that step read, God as we understand him, that would mean Narcotics Anonymous would have an understanding of God. But because it says God as we understood it gives us the individual ability to have a God of our own personal understanding. And it could be completely different from everybody else, but yet we're in the same process. And that's very important. And you were talking about the Oxford groups. There was an early edition of The Grapevine. That's the AA magazine they interviewed Bill, and they asked Bill how long it took him to put the steps together. And believe it or not, he said it took 25 minutes. He took the six steps of the Oxford group and divided it. And he said he just had divine inspiration. He sat there for 25 minutes and he had the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous written. And that's an amazing thing, too.
The greatest example of divine intervention that I've ever heard of is the reason why we have the program we have is because two alcoholics agreed on something. And when has two
Exactly.
alcoholics ever agreed on anything?
Well, without
That's
AA, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here
right.
without AA. And I
Yep.
mean, they go back to Danny Carlson and Jimmy Kennan. They both really started off in AA. And almost everybody who has a lot of clean time started off at least going to some AA meetings because there was no NA every night of the week.
Yep.
It didn't exist. You had to go someplace else. If somebody tells you, "I've been around here a lot of time and never went to an NA meeting," they're probably lying because how did you stay clean?
Yep.
You have an area where there's one NA meeting, so you went to meeting once a week to stay clean as a newcomer? I don't think so, but I could be wrong.
So
So
I
you
think to a
oh.
degree, we owe a lot to Bill Wilson also for he kind of held a very firm line around what is Alcoholics Anonymous and what it's for. Because I know that Betty Tom out of the Habit Forming Drug Group in Santa Monica was lobbying to push Bill into, allowing addicts to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a lot around that, and he kind of just drew a line in the sand. It's like, you guys could use the steps and traditions, but AA is for alcoholics.
That single is the purpose.
And he was And then in my little study, you know, like in that Chris sent us off on, he was like that from the very beginning with the Oxford group. He was always rounding up the drunks to practice their principles in the Oxford group to get alcoholics sober, and, you know, like in those principles and applied it to alcohol. And he was pretty siloed in his belief around alcohol. And so I think he also deserves some credit for inventing it, like his resistance to allowing drug addicts to be a part of, you know, like made room for NA to start.
Well, you mentioned habit forming groups. Betty of Habit Forming's group, she had many letters and correspondence in our record trying to get them to allow, you know, addicts in AA and be accepted and so forth. And he just stayed firm with that. You know, there are a lot of people that wanted to make us part of that. And of course, it would never work because Bill and Lois, anyway, they loved LSD with Timothy, whatever his name is.
Leary.
In the book, AA Comes of Age, it's in there point blank. A lot of alcoholics get pretty pissed off. I said, read AA Comes of Age, you'll find out Bill and Lois were doing LSD.
One of the things, so you got clean in 1960, and there it's kind of well documented that, you know, NA was really struggling. Jimmy Kennan's version of NA was really struggling, and around 1959, you know, they were down to almost nothing, and really took an emphasis on applying traditions. Do you remember there being an emphasis on traditions when you first got started, or?
Because first of all, Sylvia was scared to death when they were down to that one meeting. Schreier's dryer is what it was, and you know that all was the what started that was Cy Mellis. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen the interview with Cy, where he identified himself as the president of NA on the Los Angeles TV station. But when he got the job at Perry Mason, being the detective on the show, he threw his keys at Jimmy. And he says, "You take this fucking thing and go, because I'm going to be a big star from now on." And he actually destroyed NA in the 50s because he did not believe in traditions. He believed in self-promotion. And that's when they got together. And Sylvia was really scared to death because she had just gotten clean and she didn't know how she'd make it without NA. And they were down to that one meeting and they put it back together. They put it back together. Sylvia was as much of an influence on that as Jimmy was because the two of them were together. That was for Bobby. Bob didn't come in for two more years.
That was Sylvia Wexler, I believe.
That was
there's two early Sylvias. One was Magdalena, and one was Wexler.
Oh, they're the same person. That's Sylvia got married to Wexler. They're the same person. Sylvia Magdalena and Sylvia Wexler are exactly the same person. They were both up in the outside, what's that town where the university is? Berkeley. Yeah. Sylvia Wexler is, matter of fact, in 2011, I think it was, we had a dinosaur day down in Miami, and we flew Sylvia in at that time, just because she had been dead since then. We brought her in. We brought Tom from Hawaii in. We brought in Bob, came in. We brought Neil from South Carolina, Bo, and a whole bunch of things. We had a all day affair. I think it was 20 speakers of everybody at that time was over 40 years.
That was in San Jose?
No, this was in Miami.
Oh, okay.
We flew them in Dinosaur Day in Miami. I think it was 2008 or 2009, something like that. But Sylvia, she had married Wexler. That's Sylvia Magdaleno.
Oh,
wow.
Okay.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
I didn't either.
They're the same person.
Different people.
No, they're the same person.
That's interesting. So you grew up in New York,
in the Bronx. There's a difference.
In the Bronx. Grew up in the Bronx, and at one time, NA had completely died out in New York. Is that correct?
Well, no, it didn't completely. The Danny Carlson died in 1972 when Ray died, and they changed the name to Drugs Anonymous.
Okay.
And then in 80. This fellowship was able to come in because there was no Rockefeller laws, and it was Tony D and Terry Ryan and Rosalie, she's dead now, came up from Miami, and because they're originally from New York and got it started in New York City, and it's grown ever since. There was one meeting called Two Sides of the Coin. It was an AA meeting, and that's where all the addicts started to congregate before that point, and that's where NA developed out of it. And like Terry, I think, started the first meeting in Queens. Tony D started the first meeting in the Bronx, and they've been going ever since.
Yeah.
Tony Daddio.
Pardon? Tony
Tony
D.
Daddio.
He
Hey,
started
yeah, I
the
was kind of like thought about that and how that might have taken place. And when I think, like, we used to, like, anthropology, we used to think that Neanderthals were separate from, modern humans. But, like, turns out we have some Neanderthal, like DNA. Like,
Right.
so not that I'm saying that Danny Carlson's group was Neanderthal, but it almost seems like, like anything that was left over was probably just kind of absorbed by group conscience and, like became the modern, like version of Narcotics Anonymous that sprang from LA, like just
That's
because it got
exactly what happened.
absorbed.
When the Rockefeller laws were repealed and addicts could meet publicly without any form of being under arrest, the old NA, who changed the name to Drugs Anonymous in 1972, just blended in into this NA. It just was a natural process.
Right. Yeah, that's what I kind of assumed, that like they're a part of us. Like we want to draw this line down the middle that you like they were different, but at the same time, like they're ingrained in the DNA of our modern Narcotics Anonymous.
And so was habit-forming drugs and all of them, who all had this same great idea. And a lot of it came out of the Lexington, Kentucky Federal Prison, where they went in. Matter of fact, Dorothy Berry, who's a colonel in the Salvation Army, she invented the name Narcotics Anonymous in the 1930s in the New York City prison system when she was administering to addicts there. And when she got transferred from New York to Lexington, she met Ray and Danny in that prison. And when they came out, they started Addicts Anonymous, which was a group inside the Lexington. And she got transferred back to New York, and she said, "No," she says, "I started Narcotics Anonymous name here. We all know that name. Let's change it." And they changed it, and they incorporated in 1953, Narcotics Anonymous Incorporated in New York State, and that corporation is still in existence.
I
Wow.
suspect as soon as Bill and Bob got together and conjured up this thing for alcoholics, people were curious whether this would work for other drugs. Like the idea of a 12-step fellowship probably for addicts probably happened shortly after, like the Bill and Bob met. And it's just a matter of time before we find more
Right. It
evidence of that as, like old
society's
newspapers get
conscience.
scanned.
When you saw Alcoholics Anonymous work in society's conscience, can we do this to solve this problem? It's just a normal thing. I mean, it's all part of the evolution of the human species.
I'm sure you've had opportunities to go back to New York and share a bunch of times. What's that like? Is that always special to you?
Well, it is and it isn't. I get a weird feeling when I go back to New York. It's almost like the streets are calling me, and I smell where the drugs are. And there's a big pool there that I don't stay very long. When I was living in Pennsylvania, I used to go into the Howl Club a lot and just do the meetings and come back, because I sponsored a lot of guys back then. And there were a few people around that were still in from the old NA. Like, I don't know if you remember Fran O. She was a big speaker in NA. She's now Fran D. She lived in Hawaii for a while. She's back in New York. She's same age as me, but she's had a few strokes and she don't get around too much. But she was involved in the Danny Carlson NA too. Matter of fact, she was recruited by Father Dan Egan, who they called the junkie
The
priest.
junkie
And her
priest.
story she tells about when he went to help, she says, "I don't do no tricks for any damn priest." And he was just trying the 12-stepper. Fran's still alive. She's like I said, she's 85. She's the same age as me. We got clean the same age. She had a relapse, which she calls a relapse. I still question that, because she was going blind, and the doctors told her the only way they could stop it is with marijuana maintenance through for her, whatever the condition of her eyes. And she was on that marijuana for about 6 months, and she gave up her clean time over that. But that was a thing to save her eyesight. So I don't know. But she got clean same year I did, different month. But she's a great person too, and she really's got some good NA stories from way back in both the Danny Carlson NA and this NA. But she's living up to upstate New York now.
After all these years that you've been here, like what still drives you? What's the pa Where's the passion at?
I believe, and this is a personal belief, this is not necessarily fact, but it's my belief. I believe as a human being, we were all put here on earth to serve mankind. And I believe that part of my mission here on earth was that I was an addict and I got clean. And part of my mission is to continue to serve other people to show that there's a way of life. And that's what keeps me going. That's the thing when my wife says, "Oh, you've done too much NA." And I mean, she's an addict herself. And she'll say, "Get off those Zoom meetings. You go to three, four meetings a week and all this other stuff." And I say, "How do you say no to a fellowship to save your life?" I believe that part of my higher power job is to continue to serve because my first sponsor says something to me that's still very alive. And he says, "You want to have a long life and you want to have a good life." He said, "Get involved in service because when you can't serve anymore, God's going to take you and replace you with somebody who can serve." So I'm not ready to leave, so I keep serving. But that's my own personal belief. That's not fact, that's my fact.
Right. And I'm sure you've seen tons of people who stayed around for many, many years who just kind of drifted away, not necessarily a relapse, but just kind of drifted away from the fellowship. Have you seen that time and time again?
Story that I'd like to say is that when I first got clean for the first 20 years or so, I went to a meeting with a guy almost every night by name of, we'll call him Vince. And he was just another heroin addict and so forth. And we sat there and he wound up getting one of these early franchises for garage doors, where they automatically unlock. And he started making a lot of money and he became a millionaire quickly, quickly. And he said to me, he said, "I'm in business now. I make a lot of money. I've been coming around for 20 years. I know the steps. I know everything that needs to be done. I need to start networking out, going to cocktail parties and everything." He says, "Anyway, alcohol wasn't my thing anyway." And I said, "Vince," I said, "I'd be afraid of doing that." He said, "No, it's not a problem." 3 weeks later, he was found dead in the gutter with a needle in his arm.
Wow.
20 years of recovery, 3 weeks of using. Boom, dead.
Yeah.
So it's I fear that when I hear, "I know what to do. I've been around for a long time. I can do that." I left the fellowship when I had 16 or 17 years clean. I didn't leave the fellowship, but I stopped going to meetings. Show up once a year, pick up my chip. "Hello, peons, just keep coming back. You'll be able to come here and do it." And what happened is I had a family emergency that was a catastrophe, or I considered. And I knew I was going to go out and use, and I locked myself in my bedroom. I remember punching holes in the wall, trying to think. Finally, morning came, and the Pied Piper was out there still calling me. I put a rope around my neck, and I hung myself. And thank God, the woman I was married to at that time cut me down. And they come and they took me to psych ward because I tried to kill myself. And when I was being intake, the psychiatrist said to me, she said, "Vito," she says, "you're a little loony like most people are, but your biggest problem is you're an addict without a program. That if I don't commit you, do you promise to get back and do the things that you did in recovery?" And I said, "Yeah." And I remember when I left there, the words of my first sponsor saying to me, "When you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you begin to rot." And I had hit that point of rotten because I thought I was better. I thought I was cured. I thought I was better than everybody else. And I could say, "Hey, peons, just keep coming back. You'll get better." And it was a lesson that I learned, and I never stopped coming back since then. And that's why I still do service.
Wow. We had Tom recently, and I keep saying this on every episode, but it's really touched me. He talked about the first idea for the Living Clean. The title was From Desperation to Passion. It didn't stick, but his ex explanation was is that like desperation is what brings us here, but what keeps us here after the desperation's gone, it's got to be passion. And I find my passion in service, and that's what keeps me connected. And I don't want to disconnect from that passion because the only thing left to come is desperation.
Service is addiction and it can be addicted, but it's a healthy addiction.
Yeah.
All addiction isn't bad. There's healthy addiction and destructive addiction. And service, now service can get to a point where you have no personal program and you're all about service as your program. That's bad too. But if you
Yeah.
have the balance between recovery and service, it's the best thing in the world. I think that's keeping you right in the middle.
I agree.
Just opinion, but that's what I believe.
We're right bumping right up against our hour. I was one of the things that we did when we interviewed Motorcycle Ed was asked him if he had a burning desire and if there was something that you would like to. Are we winding down, Mason? Or yeah, if there was something that you'd like to share, maybe that it hasn't been. Like I know you speak a lot. I know that you do some history stuff, so. But is there like a message you want to get out there, a burning desire that you may have that you want to share?
Well, the only message that I want to get out there is a message that I really believe in, and that is to serve fellow mankind. And if we're in the program of Narcotics Anonymous, that means serving other addicts. Being there to carry the message continuously, make sure there's a fellowship to continually carry the message, be part of it, never stop doing service. My first sponsor told me, very beginning, and that's still in my DNA, says when you stop doing service, God is going to replace you with somebody who's capable of doing service. And so I'm not ready to leave the earth yet. I'm going to continue to do service until my higher power says stop by shutting me down. And when I'm shut down and can no longer get there, then I'm going to do it. I strongly believe as long as you keep doing service for the right reason, not for ego, if you have a program, you do your personal recovery and serve at the same time, you will always have a good life. No matter what disaster falls you, a solution will always be there. And I think that's part of the message of Narcotics Anonymous. Keep coming back, keep giving, and your life will keep getting better. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Vito. That was incredible. Thank you for taking the time and giving us this hour, and we appreciate you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for asking
Thank
me.
you. What a privilege it is to spend an hour with you.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it. And I wish you luck. And if you need some numbers of people that you may not have, I can get them for you.
Well, thank you.
Oh.
I'll
Thank
be in
you.
touch. And when this episode drops, I'll send you a link.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Have
Yep.
a good one.
And we'll be back next week with another episode. See you then.
Thank you for joining us on our Living Clean podcast. This is another platform that we can share our message of recovery, which is an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Join that no matter what club. You can contact us through text. The number is 931-306-9364.